From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. On today's show, what's next for the state budget in 2013?
Republicans, after the first year of GOP dominance in Lansing, got pilloried for the cuts they made to school funding at the same time that they were eliminating the Michigan business tax.
Plus, we explore the waves of dark money.
The citizens of this state have a right to know where the money's coming from that's driving elections and driving the policy process.
And creating a safe and comforting space, makeover projects for homeless shelters.
It's like a warming feeling to see all of this new paint and stuff going on.
We'll have those stories and much more on today's Stateside. But first, the news. From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, and today for Cynthia Canty. On today's show, Dark Money. We'll talk to the director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network about the invasiveness of these funds in Michigan. What's really done with the money, and how might it affect decisions over policy in the state? Also, Governor Snyder plans to talk transportation funding in next week's State of the State address. We'll check in on the state of our roads and try to figure out why it seems so hard to fix our crumbling bridges and highways. And a report says Michigan is now the fifth largest winemaking state in the country and only growing. We'll have that story coming up later in the show. But first, there's a meeting tomorrow morning in Lansing at the state capitol. State budget officials and economists will gather for what's called the Revenue Estimating Conference. Okay, not the most intriguing title, but the meeting actually really matters. It's where state officials figure out how much money they're going to have to work with. Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, will be at the Revenue Estimating Conference tomorrow. And Rick, is it fair to say that decisions aren't really made at this meeting? Instead, it's sort of a meeting that becomes the basis for a bunch of other decisions that lawmakers and the governor will make in the coming year?
Yeah, sort of in the corporate parlance that's become popular in Lansing, this would not be considered a decision meeting as much as a positioning meeting. What this is it's really a great big economic seminar that all, you know, these experts come in and give presentations about what we're anticipating in terms of the auto industry and how many cars and trucks we expect will be sold in 2013, what the price of fuel will be, you know, just all these things that are factors in the economy. And from that, they'll make a determination of how much money the state will take in revenue in the coming year. And that will determine things like, well, if you've got kids in school, how much each one of those kids is worth to the school district in the form of the foundation allowance.
Right. I mean, this really sets the basis for decisions that are going to be made about what programs to cut or what departments to fund.
Exactly. They're really coming to a conclusion on the state budget kind of moves in two directions. And one is what I'll call the demand side. And that's, you know, the programs. And the people who run them will say, this is how much this particular program is costing us this year. This is how much we expect it to cost next year based on the price of things and what the demand will be. Usually it goes up. Sometimes it goes down. And that sort of filters up in the process. And then at the top is revenue, the supply side, and that's how many dollars are available to do what you want to do. So this meeting tomorrow, which are, you know, economists with the legislature, the House and the Senate and the state treasury, will say this is how many billions of dollars that you have to work with. And the state budget is a lot bigger than the amount of money that you have to work with, but a lot of it is earmarked. It's committed to a particular purpose. So what they'll say is, here's how much you've got for the general fund. Here's how much you've got for the school aid fund. And then that will filter down. The governor and legislative leaders will create what are called targets. How much, you know, are you going to allocate for each big area of spending? Schools, higher education, human services, and then those targets will be handed to the legislators who are in charge of the budget committees, and then they'll take that money and allocate it accordingly, making adjustments along the way. This is the first revenue estimating conference. There will be another one in May, just before the budget is supposed to be finalized, to say, okay, you know, here's how it looks like things are now, and you'll tweak those numbers accordingly.
So the meeting is tomorrow morning, but we have some details right now.
Some sense of the direction things are taking.
Exactly. The state ended 2012 with a surplus of more than $1 billion. That number coming from a Senate Fiscal Agency report that was released last week.
Right. But one of those economic agencies that participates in this meeting.
Exactly. But according to that report, it's looking like the state will probably use that surplus as tax revenues are expected to be smaller than previously estimated. Mm-hmm. But then this week, the House Fiscal Agency came out, said, no, those are a little too dire predictions. Budget Director John Nixon is saying things aren't going to be that bad. So what do we know as of now going into tomorrow?
Well, this isn't as big a disagreement as it might seem like. It was expected that economic growth would level off a bit and that some of the revenue that was being raised this year would be used to help deal with some spending pressures this year. But that said, it looks like what the Senate Fiscal Agency came up with is a bit more pessimistic than what we're seeing out of the House, what we're seeing out of the Snyder administration. This actually speaks to the dilemma that this consensus revenue estimating conference was supposed to solve. That, you know, you go back a few decades before they did this, that the House came in with their numbers and the Senate came in with their numbers and the governor's office came in with its numbers. And very often they were different. And a whole lot of time was spent arguing over whose numbers were correct. So the idea behind this is that in two meetings of roughly 3 hours each, twice a year, all of these agencies will come together and come up with a number that they can all agree on. And this is not a small thing. It was so difficult that at the beginning, these conferences used to deadlock, that they'd walk out not getting it done. And so, you know, now they've sort of finally got it figured out. So it's kind of a civil and civilized process.
You're listening to Stateside here on Michigan Radio. I'm Zoe Clark in today for Cindy Canty, talking with Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, talking about the very exciting Michigan state budget. Tomorrow, we'll get some better estimates about just how much money the state has in its proverbial bank account.
Rick, and they are estimates as time goes on throughout the year. As a matter of fact, by the time you get to May, people are not ignoring these numbers, but they know that they're about to change. And so this is just sort of, you know, the first set of digits that go into the governor putting together his budget proposal that's going to be presented in early February, and then, you know, going on through the process of hearings and negotiations and whatnot, leading to getting the budget done, they hope, by early June for a fiscal year that begins October 1st.
And that's where I want to go to next. We can remember some years in the middle aughts, let's say 2007, 2009, under then-Governor Jennifer Granholm. Lots of budget issues, how to balance the budget, the fights to where the government actually shut down for a couple of minutes. It feels like we're past that, and yet we are seeing some maybe structural imbalances in the years ahead, some economists are saying. So are we likely to see these fights again, or because we have a Republican majority, will they sort of figure it out?
Check the latter box. In 2007, 2009, we had a Republican Senate. We had a Democratic House, but the House Speaker was often at odds with the Democratic governor, Jennifer Granholm. We don't, you know, have that this year. Certainly, there are disagreements between Governor Rick Snyder, between House Speaker Jace Bolger, between Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville, and their respective caucuses. But they're not going to play out in public the way that they did in 2007 and to a lesser degree in 2009. And remember, too, that, you know, under Republican control, that if you look at sort of the overarching purpose of being a Republican is to cut taxes and, you know, hopefully, if you're doing it right, cut spending, if that's, you know, what it comes to. Republicans don't lose political points for doing that kind of stuff, with a few notable exceptions, school funding, the per pupil foundation allowance being one of them.
Well, and I want to talk about school funding. This report that we've just been talking about from the Senate Fiscal Agency, it's warning that cuts might have to be made to per pupil funding, about $150 per student. Is this a fight, another fight over education that politicians want to have right now?
No, it is not a fight that they want to have right now. And Republicans, after the first year of, you know, GOP dominance in Lansing, got pilloried for the cuts they made to school funding at the same time that they were eliminating the Michigan business tax and creating this new corporate income tax to replace it. This year, we've got the beginning of the phase out of the personal property tax, which a lot of local governments rely on for funding for things like schools. It's the tax on industrial equipment and business equipment. So they're not going to want to risk, you know, going into 2014, big cuts, if any cuts at all, in the per pupil funding. I predict, and it is a prediction, that they will find a way around that.
And looking forward, Wednesday, the governor is set to deliver his State of the State address. How much is he watching these estimates coming from the Revenue Estimating Conference tomorrow as he's putting together this address, or is he not basing any of proposals or things we might hear next week on the numbers tomorrow?
A nerdy governor who never passes up the opportunity to remind you that he's a CPA? No, not at all.
Rick Pluta is Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Rick, thanks so much and have fun tomorrow at the Revenue Estimating Conference.
I will. It's very interesting.
Here at Stateside, we always want to hear from you. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. We're on Facebook. Just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Still to come, Governor Snyder plans to introduce a framework for funding roads and bridges in next week's State of the State address. Coming up, we'll find out why it's been so hard to pay for good infrastructure here in Michigan. And the state's wine industry is continuing to grow. We'll find out why, coming up in 15 minutes. This is Stateside, here on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in for Cindy Canty. It's been announced that Governor Snyder plans to propose a more detailed way to boost transportation funding in next week's State of the State address. Transportation funding is high on the governor's agenda for the new year. He's previously called for almost $1.5 billion more a year for roads and bridges, but measures to increase funding have stalled in the Republican-led legislature. It seems like everyone can agree that the state really needs to fix its crumbling infrastructure. What they can't seem to agree on is how to pay for it. Joining us now is Eric Lufer, Director of Local Affairs at Citizens Research Council, and Richard Murphy. He's with the Michigan Suburbs Alliance. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So, Eric, you've done tons of research on the state of our roads and bridges. First off, how bad are they?
They are among the worst in the nation. It doesn't take much driving around, especially southeast Michigan, southern Michigan, to realize they're crumbling beneath us, to drive under a bridge and look up and see some of the decaying infrastructure. We've really had a funding problem for many years, and it's coming home to roost. Something needs to be done soon.
Economically speaking, you know, what are the consequences of the state having such poor infrastructure? I know a few years ago, the Michigan Department of Transportation said the roads cost us $7 billion a year. Is that possible? Richard?
Yeah. Maintaining the roads as well as the rest of our transportation network costs a large amount, even if we're not building anything new. And certainly with the demand that we're seeing in the state for more options like transit and rail connections between cities on top of the road repair needs, we really have some strategic investment needs to keep our state attractive to residents and businesses.
Mm-hmm. Economically speaking, though, Eric, what kind of damage do we see because of the poor infrastructure?
Yeah, that was the point I was going to make. Whether you pay it in taxes or not, you're going to pay for it. For businesses, this results in greater cost and just-in-time delivery, trying to navigate this decaying infrastructure to get products to the manufacturers when they need it results in lost money for manufacturing. For the average driver, upkeep on your car when you have to go to the bump shop to fix the damage that potholes are doing, things like that. We're going to pay one way or the other. Wouldn't it be nice to have good roads and just pay the taxes on it instead of all that other cost?
Right. Okay. So we get it. The roads are bad. I want to spend the next bit of time, though, really sort of talking about the solutions. One possibility that there always seems to be a lot of talk about, but at least in the past decade, not action, is the idea of raising our gas tax. This is something Governor Snyder talked about in 2011. He called for replacing the 19-cent per gallon tax with a tax on the wholesale price of fuel. That never happened. Why not?
Why not is simply because of the whole anti-tax measure movement that's going on, the sense that people aren't interested in paying more taxes. And now with the economy down, the idea of collecting more in taxes, it's really resonated with people, and it's kept us from moving forward. And it goes back a long time. There's been efforts through the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, the early 2000s. This isn't anything new.
Well, and also people are driving less and vehicles are getting more fuel efficient. And so even if however we move around the gas tax, it's still going to be a declining revenue source over time and not necessarily going to be the one and only thing that we need to do to fix the budget needs.
I want to get creative here. So we've talked about the gas tax. We've talked about all these ideas that don't seem to be gaining traction. Richard, let's start with you. Are there some ideas for some sort of new ways to get this done?
Well, another option would be to look at sales tax, which a large number of states use to fund transportation. That would require going to the voters in order to get that passed, but it would provide a revenue source that's not tied to how much people are driving or vehicle efficiency. The other piece of the equation, of course, is looking at how we're spending the money and making sure that we're getting the most bang for our buck and the highest return on investment. And repairing roads is a good investment, but maybe we don't need to widen roads or build additional freeway interchanges. Maybe we can make our money stretch farther if we're looking at maintaining what we already have and making our systems a little more robust, to the fix-it-first mentality. But also, the governor has talked about aligning transportation spending with economic development through placemaking and looking at how do we invest in the types of walkable places with transit and a bunch of options for people, not just roads, in order to attract residents. And so looking at what investments are we making, and is it just the roads that we're talking about, or where do these other pieces come in?
Mm-hmm. Okay. If you're just joining us here on Stateside, I'm Zoe Clark in today for Cindy Canty, talking about road funding, or the lack thereof, with Eric Lufer, Director of Local Affairs at Citizens Research Council, and Richard Murphy, who's with Michigan Suburbs Alliance. Eric, and you know, you've done the research. What are some other solutions out there?
Yeah, clearly we have a revenue problem, so that shouldn't be dismissed at all. But part of the problem is what we do with the money once we have it. Michigan is rather unique in that we have the state collect most of the money and then pass it down to local governments. And we have an antiquated formula for doing that, so that if we can identify that Southeast Michigan has X amount of need, we have to collect X times four in order to get that amount of money to where it really needs to be. We fund the roads based on the jurisdiction rather than the type of road. We have problems in that we build roads kind of to their basic minimum structure so it'll last 25 or 30 years, and then there's this plan to come back and fix it up. But when you look at our geographic location and the environment we live in, a typical winter with the freeze-thaw cycle that we put our roads through and the heavy trucks that's necessary for manufacturing, it really argues that we should build roads to a higher standard and have them last longer. It costs more on the front end, but we'll have better roads for a longer period of time as a result. So there's many things that can be done once we have the money to use it better and to make it last, to really give us a better product in the long term.
Yeah, Richard, you're nodding your head.
Right. There's definitely a need to invest in our transportation system. And we've talked to people all across the state who recognize that need, who are willing to pay a little bit more for the transportation system. They want to know that it's going to be invested wisely and that it is going to serve their needs and make a difference. And as Eric said, we are tied to some very old formulas as how the funding is distributed.
And that's what I'm hearing. I mean, Eric, you used the word antiquated, and I was reading that since the 1960s, Michigan has continually been ranked in the bottom 10 states for state and local transportation funding. It seems so odd, I guess, considering, you know, we're the automotive capital of the country. It seems like there's the data. There's a lot of push that this needs to happen, and yet it continually hasn't. And I'm still trying to wrap my head around why not. Eric.
Yeah, the million-dollar question is, what will it take to really get it done? It's been done basically on about a 20-year cycle that they finally get the political will to do it. And this is coming up on about 20 years. But often they've come in with these grand visions for let's fix everything all at once. We can get you the more money, but we're going to have to change the way it's done. And that takes a sort of give and take between the state and the county road commissions and the cities and villages, the role of townships, the role of transit. Everyone wants a piece of that dollar coming in, that new dollar coming in the door. And a lot of time it's broken down because of that. I'd rather nobody have anything than somebody get something and I get less of it. And that's that sort of political give and take that's necessary that makes it more difficult than just deciding whether more money is necessary. Who's going to get that money once it's in the door?
Yeah. Okay. So I mentioned, and sort of one of the reasons why we have you gentlemen here today is because Governor Snyder says he's going to put out a framework next week, Wednesday, when he delivers the State of the State address. We don't quite know yet what that framework is going to look like. Eric, in a perfect world, how you study things, what would it look like? How would we fix the problem of our infrastructure, our roads? What do you want to hear next Wednesday?
In the perfect world, it would call for more revenues. It would change the way we fund roads, so we're not funding it based on county road commissions or that each city gets so much, but we would say our interstates are worth so much per dollar, our major roads are worth so much, our when you go on all the way down to the most local streets that we have our houses on, those are worth dollar amounts that are varying based on their need, based on their traffic patterns. We would set higher standards for building the roads. Germany builds deeper, thicker roads, and they last a lot longer. The examples out there that we can follow, we would do more with transit and multimodal transportation to use all of the resources that are available to us, minimize our impact on the environment with everything we're doing. It needs to be a holistic approach to changing what we do. Revenue needs to be part of it, but much bigger than that.
Richard, your perfect transportation world.
Well, as Eric said, revenue needs to be part of it, and that needs to be some form of revenue that's not tied directly to gas mileage by automobiles. And we need to be making sure that we're investing that revenue strategically. Now would be a great time to re-examine what exactly our priorities and our needs are and make sure that the projects we've got lined up are actually matching those and see if there are cheaper ways to accomplish the same needs if things like the Ann Arbor to Detroit commuter rail that's been in the works for a while.
For a long while.
It has a very low price tag compared to some of the freeway projects that are out there. So, if we can add options into the mix and give our residents and businesses new choices that they're saying they want, now's a good time to get away from some of those antiquated formulas that push us towards building roads regardless of what we actually want to do.
Eric Lufer is the Director of Local Affairs at Citizens Research Council, and Richard Murphy is with the Michigan Suburbs Alliance. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Let's turn to wine now, Michigan wine to be exact. According to the Michigan Grape and Wine Industry Council, wine was made in Michigan as far back as three centuries ago. As early as 1679, French explorers made wine from grapes growing along the Detroit River. Okay, so let's jump forward now 300 years to a report now that says Michigan is the fifth largest winemaking state in the country. According to the Michigan Grape and Wine Industry Council, there are 101 commercial wineries producing more than 1.3 million gallons of Michigan wine annually. That number has increased from just 32 wineries in 2002, producing only about 400,000 gallons. Christopher Cook is chief restaurant critic and wine writer for Our Magazine, and he recently wrote a piece in Our about the increase in Michigan wines. Chris, welcome.
Thank you, Zoe. It's nice to be here.
So you wrote in your piece, as I mentioned, 101 commercial wineries. That's up from 32. The industry is growing.
It is, and it's actually been growing for quite a while. One of the sort of interesting little lost facts is when our auto industry was in so much trouble, the wine industry was just beginning to boom. And it's really in that period of the last decade that it has come the distance that it has. And it has now reached a point both in quality and in size where it is being recognized across the country, even across the world in some cases, to places that have similar grapes that we grow here.
So help us understand why the increase. You say the climate is good for it, but why just in the past, it feels like a decade, are we seeing such a spike?
Well, I think there's several reasons. One of the important ones is a changing palate of the American wine drinker. There's something in the wine industry now that's been kicking around quite a few years. It's called ABC, Anything But California. and it has to do not that California makes bad wine, but that they make a particular kind of wine. And the American palate in many places is becoming far more connected to the European palate. Therefore, we like wines. Those people like wines. I am one of them. That tend to be far more acid and a little sharper and not as heavy. And that's what you get in a climate like Michigan. And we're seeing this new regionalism in American wine, which is a fascinating thing too.
Chris, let's talk about that regionalism. I mean, where does Michigan fit into that?
Well, as most people know, California is the big kahuna in this country. New York is second. And then there are other regions that have been growing, Oregon, Washington primarily. And so those are really the top four. Michigan's beginning to slide in somewhere right after that because of the size that we're in. And again, it's got to do with this changing search for different kinds of wine. And it's particularly among the younger generation that hold no prejudices that you have to drink Chardonnay. They like to try so much more than the older generation do. And we tend to think that that's, we who do this kind of thing, tend to think that that's probably part of that pattern, though there's not a lot of very good research on it.
Okay, well, help me understand that new palate, the new taste. Is there one sort of defining element?
Yeah, curiosity.
Oh, okay.
I think that's it. That's probably the broader definition of it. And it is with the younger generation, the 20 to 30-year-olds. They're seeing them go out and try things like Petit Syrah and all kinds of strange grapes like Tanat from the southern regions of France and Uruguay, for instance, where they grow it. They'll try things, whereas the older generation of wine drinkers stuck very much to the basic French grape varieties. They still do, but they're looking at the younger people are looking at a different version of those older grape varieties. The other part of it simply is that the viticulture is so much better for growing grape now. We understand more about growing grape in colder climates. It's dangerous, too. I mean, there's a couple of years ago, Michigan lost a huge part of its Chardonnay crop because of a sudden freeze. Mm-hmm. But there are more weather-hardy grapes being grown in this country also and in different areas. And that alone has allowed some of these regions, like we're seeing wine coming out of Iowa. Wisconsin's got some fabulous wines. Pennsylvania's always been there a little bit, but certainly you see them. New York's always been the big player in those cooler climate Rieslings and things like that. And most of what we're growing here remains Riesling. It's still the dominant grape. But we are now seeing Pinot Noir, which 15 years ago people didn't think you could grow in Michigan because the climate was too cold.
And I guess that's my next question. I mean, what is climate change going to do for Michigan wine grapes in, let's say, the next decade?
Well, you know, that's almost calls for a scientific prediction of some kind, and I really couldn't fully answer that other than to say that anecdotally, it has been warmer in this state an awful lot, and we've had longer stretches of warm weather. And couple that with winter hardier grape, you just get a broader growing season. And that's really a very important thing to make wine. It has to obviously mature and ripen before it's cultivated. And that's what we used to have difficulty getting to. It seems we have less difficulty getting to that now.
Okay. Well, Chris, here's a toast to the curious wine drinker. Christopher Cook is chief restaurant critic and wine writer for our magazine. Chris, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Still to come here on Stateside, we'll ask, is the state being swamped by a toxic wave of dark money? We'll talk to the executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. That story in 15 minutes. You're listening to Stateside here on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cindy Canty. Imagine if you were homeless and you were about to spend several months in a shelter or another residence. You probably wouldn't want to stay in a place with dirty windows, stained mattresses, and used beds from a prison. Instead, how about freshly painted walls, curtains, and maybe homemade bedspreads? Stateside's Kyle Norris tells us about one local woman who thinks a beautiful physical space is crucial to helping people make dramatic changes in their lives.
It started with a phone call about 8 years ago. Back then, Terry Grail was an interior designer with her own business. She got a call from a homeless shelter, from someone asking if she'd be willing to volunteer a little time and maybe paint a wall. Grail wasn't really feeling it, but she decided to swing by the shelter and check out a space where women and their kids lived for up to a year as they made big changes in their lives. The shelter's director walked Grail up the stairs into the women's dorm.
It was really horrific. I mean, that's how I felt, and I saw everything was broken.
The room was filled with used bunk beds that came from a prison.
And everything was chipping. The paint, the windows were painted this brown, horrible brown color. The windows were dirty. And I always say that the windows and doors are the eyes and ears to a home. And there was 15 prison beds, 4 cribs, all duct taped up. Even the lights from the ceiling were falling down.
She says the women were sleeping with used bedspreads from a nursing home. Grail was overwhelmed because this place needed a lot of help. And as a mother of 4 kids, she didn't have any cash. So she forgot about it for a week. And then she looked at some pictures she had taken when she visited the shelter. And amongst the stained mattresses was something that caught her eye, a white pillow with polka dots.
And I heard, "Trust me." And I knew without a doubt that was God saying, "You need to do this." And no one was around. I just put my hand up in the air and said, "I'll do it." And I had no clue how I was going to do it. I just literally took that leap of faith.
She met with women from the shelter to get their feedback. And she spent hours listening to them and learning about their stories and their struggles. And Grail says she started to cry.
When you sit with women for hours and have to look in people's eyes, how can it not go back to looking at your own life? You know, I went back to the childhood. I mean, obviously I didn't want to think about those things anymore, but grew up with any money. It was the food stamps, moving 12.
Grail's family eventually moved into a worn-down house that the church gave them, with weeds and tires in the front yard. And she remembers her mom painted the walls, fixed up the house, and made curtains and clothes on her sewing machine.
And I think that restoration of the house, I know now as an adult that she was restoring herself, you know, and I felt all that growing up, and that represented hope.
Ladies.
We are at a women and family treatment and shelter at Detroit Rescue Mission Ministries. The women have lived in drug houses or abandoned buildings or jail before coming here. And they're at the shelter, sometimes with their children, for treatment and transitional housing. Up on the top floor, everything reeks of fresh paint. The long hallway has just been painted sky blue by Niles Industrial Coatings. It's a professional paint company that donates its services and products.
The doors are like an apple green from the 50s. And those are going to be painted a vintage 50s aluminum screen door on top of that.
Wait, what do you mean there's going to be a door painted on
it? Another screen door that's going to be painted right on top of that door, so it looks like their own little apartment.
Oh, that's clever. A screen door painted on top of the literal door.
Yes, it's all of the visual and imagination.
A church in Taylor is making curtains for all the rooms, and an artist will paint murals on the walls. The shelter is also getting a new sewing room and new floors and new ceiling fans. And Grail made all of those things happen through her nonprofit called Enchanted Makeovers. On the third floor, there are 20 dorm rooms for the women and kids. The rooms have been painted lemon drop yellow and a very Pepto-Bismol pink. Carol Buford is a resident of a pink room. She says it feels like the place is coming alive.
Well, before, there was a lot of writing on the walls. You can tell that maybe a kid was in here because there was a lot of scribbling and everything. And now it's just gorgeous. I love it.
Buford says she feels better because it's brighter and cleaner. She says when she sees all the volunteers who've helped with the makeover, she realizes a lot of people care.
For me, that's a great thing, because I've always felt like I was alone. Now I feel like I'm not. Now I feel like a part of something.
A symphony of volunteers and businesses help with these large-scale makeovers. And it's been an epic and not easy journey for Terry Grail to make these projects happen. She's roped in countless volunteers and gotten businesses to donate hundreds of thousands of dollars in products and services. Everyone at Enchanted Makeovers is a volunteer, including Grail, who runs the nonprofit during the day. To earn a living, she cleans toilets at night. And all those volunteers have transformed this space into something beautiful. Judith Strong says she's here for recovery.
It's like a warming feeling to see all of this new painting and stuff going on. And then with the women here, it makes us feel more at home, comfortable, safe.
You said it was a warming feeling. Can you describe that?
Can you imagine being at grandma's house when you go for the holidays or something? There you go.
She also says having her own space helps her keep a clear mind and feel peaceful and joyful. And designer Terry Grail says ultimately what she does is not about interior design, but using creativity to help people rediscover a sense of self-worth, especially people who may be going through one of the roughest times in their life. For Stateside, I'm Kyle Norris.
Turn now to the topic of dark money. It's an ominous sounding term, and it's causing alarm bells to go off in the minds of many who are studying politics and policymaking. Rich Robinson is one of those voices raising the alarm over dark money. He's the executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Stateside's host Cindy Canty sat down this week with Robinson to talk about his recent article in Dome Magazine called The Culture of Dark Money.
So, Rich, you put it right out there. Here's your quote. We are being swamped by a toxic wave of dark money. You really feel strongly about this.
I feel very strongly about it. My basic premise is that people don't spend large amounts of money in politics for philanthropic motives. They're advancing their own interests in politics.
So there's a quid pro quo there.
Well, I don't. However we describe it, I mean, I want to give the office holders the benefit of the doubt and don't want to cast aspersions on their motivations. But I think that you have to recognize that people who spend money in politics are rational economic actors, and they're pursuing their own interests. And I think the money has an effect on the outcome of elections, on the whole development of public policy. And I think the citizens of this state have a right to know where the money's coming from that's driving elections and driving the policy process.
Well, just so we are all on the very same page, when you use the term dark money, you're talking about?
I'm talking about money for which you can't account the source. And two of the biggest vehicles for dark money are the state political parties, the Michigan Democratic Party and the Michigan Republican Party. Between them, they spent $10 million for television advertising in the Michigan Supreme Court campaign in 2012, none of which was reported in the state's campaign finance reporting system, and neither were the contributions that paid for the expenditures reported. To set the scale for that, the six major party candidates collectively raised about $3.4 million for the campaign. And the state parties weren't the only ones playing the dark money game in the Supreme Court campaign. A D.C.-based nonprofit called the Judicial Crisis Network spent somewhere around $1 million for television ads directed at now Justice Bridget McCormick. So essentially what you have is the dark money in the campaign outweighing the candidate's own campaigns 3-1. Now, people should be concerned to that, not just because we'd like to know and we're curious about who's spending money in these campaigns, but because no one has a motivation to spend that kind of money like a litigant who has a high-stakes case in the appeals pipeline. Mm-hmm. So the potential is here to really compromise the whole premise of impartial justice. And I think that that's something that ought to concern everybody in the state of Michigan. I'm sure it feels pretty uncomfortable for the justices on the court.
We did profiles, as you know, before the elections with the justices, all the candidates, and to a person, to a judge, they each expressed unhappiness with the situation as it exists, with having to be nominated by a party and just the whole system. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, talking about dark money with Rich Robinson of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. His recent column in DomeMagazine.com is entitled The Culture of Dark Money. And in your column, Rich, you state that dark money really plays a bigger role in Michigan politics than in national politics. Why do you think that is?
Because we've allowed it to. This pattern of dark money, particularly in Supreme Court campaigns, goes back to the 2000 election. From 2000 through 2012, a majority of the money spent in our Supreme Court campaigns has been from unaccountable sources, dark money. The total now is well over $30 million in that time, which is way more than the candidates have raised. And it's not just in Supreme Court campaigns. In the 2010 election cycle in Michigan campaigns, most of the money in the Supreme Court campaign was off the books, dark money. Most of the money in the Secretary of State campaign was. Most of the money in the gubernatorial general election was. And close to a majority in the Attorney General campaign was. It's infested all of these campaigns. It's not easy to document. The methodology that I have used is collecting records from the public files of television broadcasters in the state. It's documentable, it's not easy, and it shouldn't be tolerated.
You in your column write about Governor Snyder, who has this 527 committee called the Governor's Club,
mm-hmm.
which is accountable, transparent. You can see what's happening with that.
Right.
But talk about NERD.
Well, first I'd like to say just a second a word about the 527.
Yeah.
This appears to be standard equipment now for our constitutional executives. Jennifer Granholm had one. Mike Cox had one. Terry Land had one.
Ruth Johnson's got one.
Ruth Johnson has one now. Bill Schuette does. And
what
the
does
governor.
It do?
Practically speaking, what the governor's 527 has done is bought $25,000 worth of hotel rooms at the Republican National Convention in Tampa, spends about $5,000 a month for a communications consultant, raises money from a lot of the most prominent interest groups around Lansing. So this is kind of standard procedure, but as you say, at least we can look into it and say, who's spending the money?
Yeah.
Where's the money being spent?
Whose fingerprints are on it?
But the NERD fund is entirely different.
And this is a 510c4?
A 501c4, a social welfare organization. In 2011, the committee raised $1.3 million. It was organized and established within about a month of the governor being sworn into office, so he lost his virginity relatively quickly on this. What's the money used for? Well, we know $130,000 was spent to modify his home and buy furniture, I assume for security purposes. And fair enough. I mean, I don't think any of us begrudge him that.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, where is all this money coming from? What's the rest of the money being used for? And I say this in the context of politicians, nonprofit corporations like the Kilpatrick Civic Fund. Wayne County Executive Bob Ficano has a 501c4 that has been questioned as to purpose. It's just bad business, and any number of times the governor has said he believes in transparency and accountability in politics, and he's not walking that talk with this particular committee.
What do you think that the people who are listening, the voters who are listening to our discussion and our conversation right now, need to demand of their policymakers?
First, I think with the governor, he should just close this 501c4 committee. If he needs money for extracurricular purposes, he's got a 527 committee called the Governor's Club, and he can raise money there. Now, if there are potential donors who won't participate, if they don't have anonymity, that should be too bad. He's certainly been able to raise plenty of money in that committee, and this other thing should be shut down post-haste. But the larger issue is the fact that we have allowed our, particularly our statewide political campaigns, to become dominated by unreported, unaccountable donors and unreported spending. That should not be tolerated by the citizens of this state. Now, I understand the problem is that the funders, those who give money to these committees, like their anonymity. And so here's the office holder's dilemma. On one hand, they know that the citizens want transparency and accountability. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, they know the funders don't. And so where do they line up with the funders?
And we've made it, as a society, it's so expensive and ridiculously expensive to run for any office.
It is. And the citizens of this state are going to have to lean on our elected officials to give them a sense of our values. My organization has done polling any number of times on this. The values of the citizens of this state are clear. We want transparency and accountability. But unfortunately, the legislators have demonstrated that unless we lean on them hard and demand transparency and accountability, they're not going to give it.
I want to ask you, where does the money for the Michigan Campaign Finance Network come from?
Well, a large amount of our funding comes from the Joyce Foundation in Chicago, which is a supporter of Michigan Radio as well. But I'm sometimes asked that question by money launderers and bag men who are involved in politics, and I'd like to give them a challenge. I've got a notarized list of anybody who has ever given my nonprofit as much as $5,000. That's part of our annual tax return. And if somebody can come up with a similar list from the Michigan Chamber of Commerce or from the Oxford Foundation, which is developing the proposal for the commercialization of public education in Michigan, I'll show you mine if you'll show me yours.
Why does this issue fire you up so much? What's the genesis of this? Because you are quite an avid champion of this transparency. Where did this stem and why does it matter to you so much?
Because I think that we're allowing governance to fall into the hands of self-serving wealth. I don't think that this is democracy in action. I think that this is commercialization or the monetizing of democracy. And I don't think that this is what serves the broad public best. But we've got to take responsibility for our democracy. We have to be engaged in it. We have to demand the accountability. And I think when we do, governance of our state will more likely serve all of us than the privileged few.
Rich, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me in.
Rich Robinson's executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. We've put a link to his column in Dome Magazine on our website at michiganradio.org.
So let us know what you think. Is dark money taking over our political process? Let us know. We're on Facebook at Stateside with Cynthia Canty, or tweet us. We're at Stateside Radio. Stateside was directed and produced today by Mercedes Mejia, engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, and Cameron Stewart. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Zoe Clark. Thanks for listening. Let's talk again on Monday.